content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the November 11th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine. And even though by broadcast time, the election will be settled, we will start with the main story titled, Clinton and Trump Neck and Neck at the Finish Line. The presidential race tightened dramatically as the contest entered its final days, with Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump barnstorming through key battleground states this week in a last-ditch effort to drum up critical votes. Clinton had opened up a comfortable lead, but her campaign was shaken by FBI Director James Comey's decision to inform Congress that the Bureau had found emails that could be relevant to its investigation of her private email server. In the following days, Clinton's edge over Trump in the RealClearPolitics.com national poll dipped to less than 2 percentage points, 47% to 45.3% for Trump, while her projected Electoral College lead sank from 303 to 205 to 273 to 265, with 270 needed to win the White House. The former Secretary of State hit the trail in swing states such as Ohio, North Carolina, and Florida, where she again questioned Trump's fitness for the presidency. "He sure has spent a lot of time demeaning, degrading, and assaulting women," Clinton told voters in Miami. Trump campaigned in Florida, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and New Mexico, telling a cheering Albuquerque crowd that as president he would drain the swamp in Washington, D.C. With less than a week until Election Day, more than 20 million Americans had already voted by absentee ballot and in 34 states that allow in-person early voting. The number in battleground states show mixed results, with more registered Democrats voting in Nevada and North Carolina, but Republicans having the advantage in Iowa and Ohio. What the editorial said: "The race is closer than it should be," said the Los Angeles Times. "There's no doubt Comey's vague yet politically charged October surprise has hurt Clinton's poll numbers. But even if voters have doubts about her handling of official emails, they can't justify voting for Trump. There is no comparison between Clinton's carelessness in corresponding with colleagues and the fact that her opponent is manifestly unfit for the most powerful office on earth." "The Comey revelations make an eloquent argument against the folly of early voting," said the Washington Times. "For the sake of voter convenience, states have turned Election Day into an election season. Numerous scandals and stories have broken in recent weeks that might have swayed a voter's choice for president, but those who cast their ballots in September and October missed that chance." What the columnist said: "Hey, Trump could win," said James Taranto in the Wall Street Journal. "Intentionally or not, Comey prompted voters who aren't Clinton partisans to focus on her corruption and the sheer weirdness that surrounds her, making Trump look good by comparison. Now his revitalized campaign exudes new confidence. That's not to say Trump doesn't have a steep hill to climb. The polls are still close, and the Democratic turnout operation could make the difference. Actually, turnout may be Clinton's Achilles heel," said Alex Shepard in NewRepublic.com. A new Washington Post ABC News poll showed that the share of Clinton supporters who were very enthusiastic about her candidacy nosediving from 51% to 43% following Comey's letter. "That malaise affects not only voters, but also volunteers manning phone banks, knocking on doors, and driving people to the polls. In critical North Carolina, black voters aren't turning out in the numbers they did for Obama, at least in the early vote," said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. "For that, Democrats can thank the relentless push by Republicans to restrict and limit voting in largely black neighborhoods. Early voting is a poor predictor, said Sean Trend in RealClearPolitics.com. We're not getting actual results, just the total number of votes cast and voters' party identification. Early voting tends to skew Democratic because of the party's emphasis on it. But we can't know how independents are voting, which is crucial. And while national polls may be tightening, Trump's path to victory in the Electoral College remains, well, problematic, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. Even if he takes states won by Mitt Romney in 2012 and 4-1 by Obama, Iowa, Ohio, Nevada, and Florida, Trump will still have to pick off a blue state such as Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, or he's stuck just short of 270. Our controversy of the week, the Clinton Foundation, how Bill Clinton, Inc. operated. As the election draws near, said Thomas Lifson in AmericanThinker.com, we've seen what could be the most meaningful release in the ongoing WikiLeaks saga. The anti-secrecy group last week released another trove of documents hacked from the email accounts of the Clinton campaign, including an extraordinary 13-page memo from Douglas Band, a former top aide to President Bill Clinton, detailing his work for what Band openly calls Bill Clinton, Inc. In the 2011 memo, Band brags that by leveraging Clinton Family Foundation contacts through his consulting firm, Tenio Holdings, LLC, he has lined up about $50 million in work for the former president, including $900,000 for speeches to UBS, the financial services firm, and a whopping $3.5 million a year to be honorary chairman of Laureate International Universities. Band also boasts of shaking down big corporations, including Coca-Cola, UBS, and Dow Chemical for millions in donations to the Clinton Foundation, and of securing numerous in-kind services for the president and his family for personal travel, hospitality, vacation, and the like. The Band memo has laid bare the truth about our grifters-in-chief, said Kimberly Strassel in the Wall Street Journal. The Clintons did not draw lines between their charitable work, Hillary's role as Secretary of State, their political activity, and their personal enrichment. Did Clinton Foundation donors receive a quid pro quo? Asks Betsy Woodruff and Andrew Desiderio in the DailyBeast.com. The Band memo provides no definitive proof of that, but it's clear that companies who employed Bill Clinton or donated to the foundation were given special access to the State Department. After donating more than $5 million to the foundation, Coca-Cola, for example, lobbied state to intercede in a tax dispute with Pakistan, and Pakistan later removed that tax. After lobbying state, Dow Chemical also appears to have gotten the U.S. government's support in a dispute with India. This scheme wasn't just about putting money in the Clintons' pocket, said Jonah Goldberg in NYPost.com. Since Bill Clinton left office in 2001, the Clintons have seen themselves as a royal family in exile. The deeper purpose of the foundation, the Band memo shows, was to keep all of the retainers, courtiers, and henchmen employed and the donors engaged as they plotted their return. The Band memo certainly doesn't look good for Clinton, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. But Trump remains totally unfit for office, a raging narcissist and congenital liar who would pose a menace to our democracy and a threat to national security. If Clinton is elected, there are steps she must take to limit the damage of her unethical behavior. The Clinton Foundation must be shut down or at least renamed and handed over to new non-Clinton management. Clinton should also ensure that no past donor to the foundation gets a job in her administration or an ambassadorship overseas. She needs to clean up her many conflicts of interest. Clinton also needs to address her most hard-to-manage problem, her husband, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Earlier in the campaign, Hillary suggested that she might put the former president in charge of revitalizing the economy because he knows what he's doing. In the wake of the banned memo, that is no longer an option. Bill Clinton's sleazy money chase and sexual history disqualifies him from any role in his wife's administration. If voters next week decide to return the Clintons to the White House, the first duty of the first gentleman will be to hit the golf course, play with his grandkids, and disappear. Time for our good week, bad week shorts. It was a good week for dad bods after researchers at Yale revealed that men who put on weight after fathering children live longer and are more attractive to females than their leaner, more muscular counterparts. It was a good week for peaceful transitions after the White House announced that President Obama's official POTUS Twitter feed will be wiped clean of content after the election, allowing the next president to take over the account's 11 million followers and connect directly with the people they serve. It was a good week for proof of voter fraud after a Trump supporter in Iowa was arrested for attempting to vote twice. Terry Lynn Rote, 55, cast an early ballot, but worried that her Trump vote would be changed to one for Hillary Clinton. She tried to vote again at another location. The polls are rigged, Rote told police. And it was a bad week for liberal Catholics after Pope Francis said that women would never be allowed to join the priesthood. St. John Paul II had the last clear word on this, the Pope told reporters in reference to a 1994 apostolic letter, and it stands. It was a bad week for boomer fashion after a British survey of 2,000 participants found that people should stop wearing jeans by age 53 on grounds that they look cooler and better on young people. And it was a bad week for endorsements after the official newspaper of the Ku Klux Klan announced its support for Donald Trump, landing him as the nationalist candidate who will restore America as a white Christian republic. Trump's campaign rejected the KKK's support, saying he denounces hate in any form. And while we're here, weed, guns, and the death penalty on ballots. Voters will be asked to decide on a number of statewide ballot initiatives across the country on November 8th. California, Arizona, Maine, Massachusetts, and Nevada will vote on whether to allow recreational cannabis, potentially legalizing the drug along the entire West Coast, while another four states will decide whether to permit the medical use of marijuana with a doctor's prescription. Arizona, Maine, Colorado, and Washington have ballot initiatives on raising the minimum wage, and Maine is joining California and Nevada in voting on background checks for gun buyers. Other initiatives include repealing, reinstating, or revising the death penalty in four states and deciding whether to allow terminally ill patients to end their lives with self-administered lethal drugs. We're on the briefing page now, titled, America's Missing Male Workers. The shrinking percentage of men in the workforce is one of the economy's biggest mysteries. What's to blame? How many men aren't working? More than 7 million men between the ages of 25 and 54, prime working age, have dropped out of the labor force. That means they're not only unemployed, but have also given up looking for a job. Shortly after World War II, virtually every man of prime working age was either working or looking for work. But the labor force participation rate for men has been declining steadily since the mid-1960s, from almost 97% to about 88% today. There is a smaller percentage of men working now than in 1940, near the end of the Great Depression, when the overall unemployment rate was above 14%. Nicholas Eberstadt, an economist with the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, has called the case of the missing men a quiet catastrophe, forgotten amid the broader story of America's economic recovery since the financial crisis. It is well past time for America to recognize the collapse of work for men as the grave ill that it truly is, he says. Why aren't they working? There is no one single reason. Men have been dropping out of the workforce at roughly the same rate for the past half century, through boom times and recessions alike. The decline in manufacturing jobs has almost certainly played a role. In 1970, more than a quarter of American workers, most of them men, had jobs in factories. Today, it's fewer than 1 in 10. Nevertheless, only 1 in 7 men outside the workforce says a lack of available jobs is the reason he's not working. Another problem is the explosion of America's prison population. By some estimates, 12% of adult men have been convicted of a felony, not including those currently imprisoned. Employers are reluctant to hire ex-cons, so many of these men have found themselves virtually unemployable. Who supports them? Their families and taxpayers. About 57% of men outside the workforce received some form of disability benefits in 2013, according to the Census Bureau. Overall, the number of Americans receiving disability has doubled to 8.8 million people since 1996, costing the federal government $260 billion per year. The U.S. now spends more on disability insurance than on food stamps and welfare combined. For others, especially younger men, it's often relatives who pick up the slack. Some 70% of lower-skilled men in their 20s who didn't have a job lived with a parent or close relative in 2014. How are these men doing? Not well. It isn't clear whether pain and sickness keep people out of the workforce, or if being out of work makes people sick. But nearly half of them report taking a painkiller every day. About two-thirds of the men taking pain medication were using prescription drugs, contributing to the nationwide opioid addiction epidemic that causes 78 deaths every day from overdoses on pills and heroin. About 20% of the men say they have difficulty walking or climbing stairs. About 16% report memory or concentration problems. What do they do all day? While women who aren't in the labor force often work in other ways, raising children or caring for relatives, only 28% of men without jobs have a child under 18 living with them. Men who drop out of the labor force gain an extra 2,150 hours of free time each year, and they devote a good chunk of it to watching television and movies. In 2014, an average of 5.5 hours a day. Younger men also spend lots of time playing video games. A society with so many idle men, warns liberal economist Larry Summers, is unlikely to maintain communities or have happy, cohesive families. As we are seeing this fall, such a society is prone to embrace toxic populist policies. What can be done? If the current trend holds, a quarter of prime-age men will be out of the workforce by 2050, making the economy less productive. It will also mean generations of men will be sicker and poorer than their peers in the workforce. Presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have both proposed massive infrastructure spending programs, which would at least temporarily replace lost blue-collar jobs. Job training and apprenticeship programs could also target the 85% of men outside the workforce who don't have bachelor's degrees. Liberal economists have called for wage insurance that would subsidize lower-paid work that some men see as beneath their dignity. In one survey of unemployed men, 44% said there were jobs near them they could get but didn't want to take. but a cultural shift might also be necessary. Many growing service sector professions are so-called pink-collar jobs, traditionally dominated by women, such as nursing and teaching. Conservatives would like to see the entitlement reform linking disability benefits to job training, similar to welfare reforms in the 1990s. Why haven't we had the same sort of conversation about stigmatizing or shaming unworking men that we had 20 years ago about mothers on welfare? Eberstadt asks, they were not idle. They had little kids. Living in an alternative reality. Could video games be luring men out of the workforce? Economist Eric Hurst at the University of Chicago found that young men without college degrees have replaced 75% of the time they would have spent working with time spent on the computer, mostly playing games. But while depression is a serious problem for the missing male workers, young men who aren't in college report being happier than they were in the 2000s. It may be that living in virtual realities distracts men from their deeply unsatisfying lives, but it also lessens their incentive to hunt for work, take less prestigious jobs, or make big changes in their lives. When I play a game, I know I have a few hours I will be rewarded, said 22-year-old Danny Izquierdo of Silver Spring, Maryland. With a job, it's always been up in the air with the amount of work I put in and the reward. And now we'll read a few of the best columns, starting with two from the U.S. Echoes of Putin's Propaganda. Russian state TV is warning that if Hillary Clinton is elected, the U.S. will get into a nuclear war with Russia. Strangely enough, Donald Trump is echoing that same message, said Ann Applebaum. You're going to end up in World War III over Syria if we listen to Hillary Clinton, Trump told supporters last week. Clinton has suggested she would create a no-fly zone to protect civilians being slaughtered by genocidal dictator Bashar al-Assad and his Russian allies. In response, Russian Tsar Vladimir Putin has ratcheted up his threats, hoping to persuade us to abandon Syria and let Russia do what it did in Chechnya, kill tens of thousands of people, flatten the landscape, destroy all political alternatives, and then start again with a Russian-backed dictator. Putin clearly prefers Trump, who says he will seek to get along with the dictator. That's why Russian hackers are feeding Clinton campaign emails to WikiLeaks. But no matter who wins, Putin may be planning to exploit our post-election chaos to launch a new offensive. A land grab in Ukraine, a foray into the Baltic states, a much bigger intervention in the Middle East, anything to test the new president. If that president is Trump, don't expect any objections. Social media's fake news problem. The plague of fake news is getting worse, said Brian Stelter, and in no environment is that phenomenon more apparent than in this year's bitterly divisive election. Over the past year, bogus news sites and hyperpartisan social media users have tricked or misled people on Facebook, Twitter, and partisan websites into believing false or misleading news stories about the political opposition. Some hoax sites pose as reputable mainstream sources, as with one recent fake ABC News story reposted by Eric Trump, headlined, Donald Trump Protester Speaks Out. I was paid $3,500 to protest Trump's rally. Other misleading stories make it onto Facebook's official trending news page, where they are given the aura of legitimacy and shared over and over again. This phenomenon is particularly common among partisans on both the right and left with a conspiratorial view of the world, because they are so willing and eager to buy into any story that reinforces their entrenched beliefs. Sadly, the hoax news epidemic only serves to insulate millions of voters from the truth, and to turn an already acrimonious campaign even nastier. Instead, the next time you see a dramatic news headline that seems a little too good to be true, double, no, triple check before you share. And we're on the last word now, titled this week, Bringing a Lost Friend Back to Life. When her best friend died, Eugenia Cuida couldn't believe she'd never speak to him again, said journalist Casey Newton. So she rebuilt him using artificial intelligence. When the engineers had at last finished their work, Eugenia Cuida opened a console on her laptop and began to type. "Roman," she wrote, "this is your digital monument." It had been 3 months since Roman Mazurenko, Cuida's closest friend, had died. Cuida had spent that time gathering up his old text messages, setting aside the ones that felt too personal, and feeding the rest into a neural network built by developers at her artificial intelligence startup. She had struggled with whether she was doing the right thing by bringing him back this way. At times, it had given her nightmares. But ever since Mazurenko's death, Cuida had wanted one more chance to speak with him. A message blinked onto the screen. "You have one of the most interesting puzzles in the world in your hands," it said. "Solve it." Cuida promised herself that she would. Born in Belarus in 1981, Roman Mazurenko was the only child of Sergei, an engineer, and Victoria, a landscape architect. They remember him as an unusually serious child. When he was 8, he wrote a letter to his descendants declaring his most cherished values, wisdom and justice. In family photographs, Mazurenko roller skates, sails a boat, and climbs a tree. With a mop of chestnut hair, he is almost always smiling. As a teen, he sought out adventure. He participated in political demonstrations against the ruling party, and at 16, he started traveling abroad. He first headed to New Mexico, where he spent a year on an exchange program, and then to Dublin, where he studied computer science and became fascinated with the latest Western European art, fashion, music, and design. By the time Mazurenko finished college and moved back to Moscow in 2007, Russia had become newly prosperous, and Mazurenko had grown from a skinny teen into a strikingly handsome young man. Blue-eyed and slender, he moved confidently through the city's budding hipster class. The many friends Mazurenko left behind describe him as magnetic and debonair. Cuida met Mazurenko in 2008, when she was 22 and the editor of Afisha, a kind of New York magazine for a newly urbane Moscow. She was writing an article about Idle Conversation, a freewheeling creative collective that Mazurenko founded with two of his best friends, Dmitry Ustinov and Sergei Poido. The trio seemed to be at the center of every cultural endeavor happening in Moscow. They started magazines, music festivals, and club nights. "Mazurenko was a brilliant guy," Cuida said. But in the wake of the global financial crisis, Russia experienced a resurgent nationalism, and in 2012, Vladimir Putin returned to lead the country. The dream of a more open Russia seemed to evaporate. Cuida and Mazurenko, who by then had become close friends, came to believe that their futures lay elsewhere. Both became entrepreneurs and served as each other's chief advisor as they built their companies. Cuida co-founded Luca, an artificial intelligence startup, and Mazurenko launched Stampsy, a tool for building digital magazines. Cuida moved from Moscow to San Francisco in 2015. After a stint in New York, Mazurenko followed. When Stampsy faltered, Mazurenko moved into a tiny alcove in Cuida's apartment to save money. Running a startup had worn him down, and he was prone to melancholy. On the days he felt depressed, Cuida took him out for surfing and $1 oysters. Cuida hoped that in time her friend would reinvent himself, just as he always had before. He successfully applied for an American O-1 visa, granted to individuals of extraordinary ability or achievement, and in November he returned to Moscow in order to finalize his paperwork. He never did. On November 28th, while he waited for the embassy to release his passport, Mazurenko had brunch with some friends. It was unseasonably warm, so afterward he decided to explore the city with Ustinov. Making their way down the sidewalk, they ran into some construction and were forced to cross the street. At the curb, Ustinov stopped to check a text message on his phone, and when he looked up, he saw a blur, a car driving much too quickly for the neighborhood. A blink later, he saw Mazurenko walking into the crosswalk, oblivious. Ustinov went to cry out in warning, but it was too late. The car struck Mazurenko straight on. He was rushed to a nearby hospital, where he died. In the weeks after Mazurenko's death, friends debated the best way to preserve his memory. One person suggested making a coffee table book about his life, illustrated with photography of his legendary parties. Another friend suggested a memorable website. To Cuida, every suggestion seemed inadequate. As she grieved, Cuida found herself retreading the endless text messages her friend had sent her over the years. Thousands of them, from the mundane to the hilarious. She smiled at Mazurenko's unconventional spelling. He'd struggled with dyslexia. And at the idiosyncratic phrases with which he peppered his conversation. Mazurenko was mostly indifferent to social media, and his body had been cremated, leaving her no grave to visit. Text and photos were nearly all that was left of him, Cuida thought. For 2 years, she had been building Luca, whose first product was a messenger app for interacting with bots. Backed up by prestigious Silicon Valley startup incubator Y Combinator, the company began with a bot for making restaurant reservations. Reading Mazurenko's messages, it occurred to Cuida that they might serve as the basis for a different kind of bot, one that mimicked an individual person's speech patterns. Aided by a rapidly developing neural network, perhaps she could speak with her friend once again. She set aside the questions that were already beginning to nag at her. What if it didn't sound like him? What if it did? Modern life all but ensures that we leave behind vast digital archives, text messages, photos, posts on social media, and we are only beginning to consider what role they should play in mourning. In the moment, we tend to view our text messages as ephemeral. But as Cuida found after Mazurenko's death, they can also be powerful tools for coping with loss. Maybe, she thought, this digital estate could form the building blocks of a new type of memorial. Cuida began reaching out to Mazurenko's close friends, as delicately as possible, to ask if she could have their text messages. 10 of Mazurenko's friends and family members, including his parents, ultimately agreed to contribute to the project. They shared more than 8,000 lines of text covering a wide variety of subjects. She said, "What if we try to see if things would work out?" said Sergei Pfeiffer, a longtime friend of Mazurenko's. The idea struck Pfeiffer as provocative and likely controversial, but he ultimately contributed 4 years of his texts with Mazurenko. The question wasn't about technical possibility, he said. It was, how is it going to feel emotionally? The technology underlying Cuida's bot project dates to at least 1966, when Joseph Weizenbaum unveiled ELIZA, a program that reacted to users' responses using simple keyword matching. ELIZA, which most famously mimicked a psychotherapist, asked you to describe your problem, searched your response for keywords, and responded accordingly, usually with another question. It was the first software to pass what is known as the Turing test, reading a text-based conversation between a computer and a person. Some observers could not determine which was which. Today's bots remain imperfect mimics of their human counterparts. They do not understand language in any real sense and respond clumsily to basic questions. And yet recent advances in artificial intelligence have made the illusion much more powerful. Artificial neural networks, which imitate the ability of the human brain to learn, have greatly improved the way software recognizes patterns in images, audio, and text, among other forms of data. 2 weeks before Masarenko was killed, Google released TensorFlow for free under an open-source license. TensorFlow is a kind of Google in the box, a flexible machine learning system that the company uses to do everything from improving search algorithms to writing captions for YouTube videos automatically. The product of decades of academic research and billions of dollars in private investment was suddenly available as a free software library that anyone could download. Luca had been using TensorFlow to build neural networks for its restaurant bot. Using 35 million lines of English text, Luca trained a bot to understand queries about vegetarian dishes, barbecue, and valet parking. For a lark, the company's 15-person team had also tried to build bots that imitated television characters. They scraped the closed captioning on every episode of HBO's Silicon Valley and trained the neural network to mimic characters Richard Bachman and the rest of the gang. In February, Quetta asked her engineers to build a neural network in Russia. At first, she didn't mention its purpose. But given that most of the team was Russian, no one asked questions. Using more than 30 million lines of Russian text, Luca built its second neural network. Meanwhile, Quetta copied hundreds of her exchanges with Masarenko and pasted them into a file. Then Quetta asked her team for help with the next step: training the Russian network to speak in Masarenko's voice. Only a small percentage of the Roman bot's responses reflected his actual words, but the neural network was tuned to favor his speech whenever possible. Anytime the bot could respond to a query using Masarenko's own words, it would. After the bot blinked to life, she began peppering it with questions. "Who's your best friend?" she asked. "Don't show your insecurities," came the reply. "It sounds like him," she thought. On May 24th, Quetta announced the Roman bot's existence in a post on Facebook. Anyone who downloaded the Luca app could talk to it in Russian or in English by adding @Roman. They could write freeform messages and see how the bot responded. It's still a shadow of a person, but that wasn't possible just a year ago. And in the very close future, we will be able to do a lot more, Quetta wrote. The Roman bot was received positively by most of the people who wrote to Quetta, though there were exceptions. Four friends told Quetta that they were disturbed by the project and refused to interact with it. But many of Masarenko's friends found the likeness uncanny. "It's pretty weird when you open the messenger and there's a bot of your deceased friend who actually talks like you," Pfeiffer said. "What really struck me is that the phrases he speaks are really his. You can tell that's the way he would say it, even short answers to, 'Hey, what's up?' He had this really specific style of texting. I said, 'Who do you love the most?' He replied, 'Roman.' That was so much of him. I was like, 'That is incredible.'" Several users agreed to let Quetta read anonymized logs of their chats with the bot. Many people write to the bot to tell Masarenko that they miss him. They wonder when they will stop grieving. They ask him what he remembers. "It hurts that we couldn't save you," one person wrote. The bot writes back, "I know." The bot can also be quite funny, as Masarenko was. When one user wrote, "You are a genius," the bot replied, "Also handsome." For many users, interacting with the bot has had a therapeutic effect. The tone of their chats is often confessional. One user messaged the bot repeatedly about a difficult time he was having at work. He sent it lengthy messages describing his problems and how they had affected him emotionally. "I wish you were here," he said. It seemed to Quetta that people were more honest when conversing with the dead. It turned out that the primary purpose of the bot had not been to talk, but to listen. All those messages were about love, or telling him something they never had time to tell him, Koita said. Even if it's not a real person, there was a place where they could say it. They can say it when they feel lonely, and they come back still. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Vox Media's TheVerge.com. On the Health and Science page, the lead article is South Hit Hardest by Smoking Deaths. Nearly 30% of all cancer-related deaths in the U.S. can be traced back to one thing, smoking. That's the conclusion of a major new study by American Cancer Society, which also found that a disproportionate number of these fatalities occur in southern states. The researchers estimate that more than 167,000 American adults over age 35 die from cancer linked to cigarettes each year, reports Reuters.com. About three-quarters of these deaths are due to lung cancer. The rest stem from at least 11 other forms of the disease, including cancers of the bladder, kidney, and liver. The higher rate of smoking among men creates a sharp gender divide. 34% of cancer deaths in men are due to smoking, compared with 23% in women. But it is the geographical disparity that most surprised the researchers. 7 of the 10 states with the most smoking-related cancer deaths are in the South. Arkansas has the highest rate among men with 40%. Utah has the lowest, 22%. The authors of the study blame this disparity on the power of the smoking lobby in the South, where 95% of American tobacco is grown. Smoking laws are more lenient, and cigarette taxes are significantly lower. Lead author Joni Lortet-Toulon says southern states should implement known preventive measures, such as increased excise tax, banning smoking in all public places, and reducing nicotine in cigarettes to non-addictive levels. Lying is a slippery slope. It has long been said that little fibs lead to big lies, and now scientists have the proof. NPR.org reports that researchers from University College London and Duke University asked 40 volunteers to estimate the value of pennies in a jar, then swapped their guesses with an unseen partner. The team incentivized some of the participants to lie by telling them they could keep the difference in cash between their guess and that of their partner. The volunteers initially inflated their estimates by small amounts, but the exaggerations gradually became bigger and bigger. During the experiment, the researchers monitored the participants' brains. They found that activity in the amygdala, the emotional processing hub, was strongest when the participants told the first lie, but decreased as their dishonesty escalated, suggesting their feelings of shame, guilt, and nervousness eased the more they lied. The study's author, Tally Sherritt, compared this adaptation effect to the way a strong scent becomes less potent the more you smell it. She now wants to examine whether the same is true of other negative behaviors, such as violent acts and excessive risk-taking. And there's a technology article here we'll take in. Media, new screen time rules for kids. How much time should kids be allowed to stare into their screens like zombies? Ask George Dvorsky and Gizmodo.com. For years, the American Academy of Pediatrics has advised parents to limit their children's time in front of televisions, tablets, and smartphones to no more than 2 hours per day, with an absolute ban for children under the age of 2. But no longer. In new guidelines released last month, the AAP officially abandoned its strict one-size-fits-all approach to screen time in favor of more flexible recommendations for the smartphone age. Doctors still recommend that children under the age of 18 months avoid screens altogether, But apps like Skype and FaceTime are fine for chatting with grandpa and grandma. Experts are finally beginning to recognize what parents have long understood intuitively. Not all screen time is created equal. This is a pivotal moment for anyone who is raising or working with kids, said Lisa Guernsey in Slate.com. The AAP's previous guidelines were hopelessly outdated, relying largely on studies of television's impact on children. Children between 18 and 24 months can now be introduced to digital media for brief periods, as long as it is high quality, educational programming, and apps that they watch or play alongside an adult. Similarly, children 2 to 5 years old should be limited to 1 hour per day of high quality programming, preferably with an adult as well. For older kids, the guidelines are more vague, said Deborah Netburn in the Los Angeles Times. Ideally, parents should work with their children to set personalized rules for media use. One good idea is to limit screen time before bed, since that has been shown to have a detrimental effect on sleep for people of all ages. A funny thing happened when I banned tablets in my house on weekdays and curtailed their use on weekends, said Christopher Mims in the Wall Street Journal. My kids, age 4 and 6, actually became less cantankerous and more imaginative in their play. Outside the home, they became less demanding and better at self-regulating. Now I feel like my experiment has been validated. The last thing we perpetually guilt-ridden parents need is more guidelines, said Jacob Schiller in OutsiderOnline.com. Let's be honest. For most of us parents, television is a way to distract our child. Mom and dad need a moment to get dinner on the table, drink a glass of wine in peace, or just finish the dishes without a toddler hanging off our legs. And if we're being really honest, sometimes kids need a break from us too. The new guidelines, just like the old ones, suggest there's a perfect way to do something. As parents know very well, that simply isn't the case. And we're on the Talking Points page. Supreme Court, looming crisis. Who needs a fully functioning Supreme Court after all, said Christian Ferris in HuffingtonPost.com. Not the famously obstructionist Senator Ted Cruz, who last week proposed an indefinite Republican blockade of the seat left vacant by the late Justice Antonin Scalia if Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton wins on November 8th. Since Scalia's death in February, Republicans have obstinately refused to hold hearings on President Obama's nominee, Judge Merrick Garland, arguing that voters should pick a new president to fill the seat in the 2016 election. Now Cruz, John McCain, and other Republicans have gone even further, suggesting that if they lose the presidential election, they will dig in their heels and refuse to approve any Clinton nominee, leaving an evenly divided 8-member court incapable of resolving the nation's most contentious legal and political disputes. The GOP, in other words, is planning to essentially destroy an entire branch of the federal government. It would be a bold move on the GOP's part, but the right one, said Justin Haskins in WashingtonExaminer.com. For conservatives, the Supreme Court stakes have never been higher. Clinton has vowed to select a far-left nominee who would, among other things, restrict Second Amendment rights, curtail free speech by overturning Citizens United, and protect abortion from even the most basic regulation. If, like Republicans, you truly believe that a particular nominee would wreak havoc on America, said Ilya Shapiro in TheFederalist.com, why not do everything you can to stop him? Moreover, the Supreme Court has successfully served with as few as 5 justices during its history, and there's absolutely nothing in the Constitution that requires senators to confirm presidential nominees. As a matter of constitutional law, the Senate is fully within its powers to let the Supreme Court die out, literally. There may be no law against permanent obstructionism, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. But what about the unwritten norms that allow our entire political system to function? In recent years, Republicans have decided to play politics by a different set of rules, ruthlessly refusing to compromise or negotiate, and sabotaging government at every possible opportunity. But if Clinton wins and the Democrats take back the Senate, they'll break some norms of their own and take the nuclear option of banning filibusters of Supreme Court nominations. That means nominees can be approved with just 51 votes instead of 60. Two can play this game. Obamacare. Can it be healed? President Obama once predicted that people would look back on his signature health care law as a monumental achievement, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But reality is confirming what the critics predicted. The Affordable Care Act is neither affordable nor remotely sustainable. The Obama administration just admitted that premiums for mid-level plans on the federal Obamacare exchange will jump an average of 25% in 2017 as insurers adjust to a pool of customers with too many older sick people and too few young healthy ones. The dreaded death spiral has begun, said Michael Tanner in NYPost.com. With premiums in some states soaring 116% and deductibles for some plans rising to more than $5,000, even fewer young people will sign up. Listen closely. That's the sound of a health care plan dying. This is no death spiral, no matter what Republicans might hope, said Michael Cohen in the Boston Globe. This year's premium hikes will affect only a fraction of the roughly 3% of Americans who get their insurance through an Obamacare exchange, 85% of whom receive government subsidies to minimize the cost. The reality is that in blue states that have embraced Obamacare, the program has made American health care both dramatically more affordable and humanitarian, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Competition is vigorous and price increases are lower. But in red states whose leaders are committed to its failure, the Obamacare markets are struggling. It would be fairly easy to make the technical fixes necessary to ensure the program's success everywhere, but thanks to the Republicans' relentless propaganda campaign to portray Obamacare as a sinister, catastrophic failure, it's politically impossible to do so. It will probably remain that way even after a new president takes office, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Republican nominee Donald Trump has offered no specific solution other than to repeal and replace. But unless Republicans control both houses of Congress, a full repeal, which would end Obamacare coverage for 20 million people, is unlikely. If Hillary Clinton wins, she'll have to ask Republicans to provide billions in additional funding to ensure that this new entitlement stays afloat. That's not happening. Politics have become wildly unpredictable, yet the one thing that you can count on not happening in 2017 is an Obamacare fix. Republican women betrayed by their party? I've had enough, said Amanda Carpenter in the Washington Post. As a lifelong Republican and former communications aide to Senator Ted Cruz, I spent 5 years fending off accusations that my party held anti-woman beliefs. My reward? Not only have Republican voters nominated Donald Trump, a brazen and unapologetic misogynist, but the men who lead the party have refused to disavow him. Republican women are being told that Trump's boasting of grabbing women's genitals is how men speak behind closed doors, and that we should just get over it, even after a dozen women came forward to say Trump did in fact sexually assault them, just as he described. House Speaker Paul Ryan and his fellow Trump enablers have clearly calculated it is too politically risky to offend the nominee's core supporters. After the GOP's shameful embrace of a sexist pig who's taken the party back to the dark ages, said S.E. Cupp in the New York Times, women would have to be lobotomized to believe anything the Republican Party tells them. I think I may die of schadenfreude, said Gary Legume in Salon.com. Conservatives have long dismissed the accusation that their opposition to contraception and abortion amount to a war on women, denouncing it as a cheap shot intended to smear all Republicans as sexist and misogynist. Now the conservative women who helped push that line are realizing that they belong to a party dominated by over 50 males who think that insulting and assaulting women is a forgivable flaw. Needless to say, Trump's share of the women's vote, especially the college-educated women's vote, is plummeting, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. In the battleground states, the Republican nominee is trailing Hillary Clinton among women by as much as 15 points. After this election, conservative women will have to decide whether they want to belong to a party dominated by white, angry, abusive men. The rebellion of Republican women has been one of the more interesting subplots in this election, said Michelle Goldberg in Slate.com. Will it lead to a broader feminist awakening among women on the right? Until now, conservative women were so opposed to identity politics that they insisted that women should not be viewed as a distinct class, with interests different from those of men. Yet they finally seem to be acknowledging something feminists have said for decades. Women can't trust men to look out for them. And a couple of short notes. American women are now undergoing medicated abortions nearly as often as surgical abortions, partly in response to state restrictions imposed on abortion clinics. 43% of abortions at Planned Parenthood clinics in the U.S. used medication instead of surgery in 2014. Only one of Donald Trump's four adult children has donated to his campaign. Eric Trump contributed $376.20. And we'll finish with a quote from Lewis Mumford. When one is completely whole and at one with the world, one does not need a mirror. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We have hope you have enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.